Good evening. Mary Keene here with Conversations. And this evening, our guest is Dr. Michael Edelstein, who is a clinical psychologist for more than 30 years and the author of the bestseller, 3-Minute Therapy, Change Your Thinking, Change Your Life. And it's amazing what this book has done and how many countries it has touched. So without further ado, Michael, welcome.
Thank you, Mary. It's good to be here and speak with you.
Well, it's lovely to have you. We're in Colorado today, and we've had the first rain, and that will help all the forest fires that have been going on here.
Oh, that's good. We could use some more rain here.
Well, maybe we'll just pass it over to you in California.
Okay,
tell
great.
Me,
I got my umbrella.
Oh, good. What is 3-Minute Therapy? How can you describe that for our audience?
Well, 3-Minute Therapy is a few things. It's a book that describes a particular approach to psychotherapy and to teaching you to be your own therapist. And it's also a particular exercise that I discuss in each chapter that people can do and learn to do on their own to become their own therapist, which helps them change their thinking and change their lives.
That's very important for all. That sounds like it's good for everybody. I noticed in your listings here, if someone you love suffers from anxiety, depression, panic attacks, addiction, stress, relationship problems, procrastination, or other difficulties, this is something that 3-Minute Therapy can help. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And even if it's someone you hate, it can help them too.
Well, let's hope it's love rather than hate. So what you're saying is everyone can benefit from your book.
Yeah, everyone can benefit. And the reason for that is since we're all imperfect humans with imperfect brains, we easily think irrationally, unreasonably, unrealistically, crazily. And this shows you how to straighten out your thinking. And when you straighten out your thinking, then your emotions and your behaviors are more in line with your goals as well.
What do you mean by, I love this, musty thinking?
Well, musty thinking refers to taking our reasonable preferences. I prefer to do well. I prefer to get your approval. I would like you to treat me well. I prefer that life be fair, easy, and hassle-free. Taking our human preferences and escalating them into absolute musts, shoulds, have-tos, laws of the universe. And when we do that, that's when we get ourselves disturbed and bent out of shape.
Tell me something. I hope you don't mind my asking, but how did this all come about? Where did your interest develop? Was it as a young person, or was it some event that occurred?
It was as a young person when I was a teenager. I was depressed most of the time, anxious the rest of the time. One of my favorite pastimes was discussing with a depressed friend of mine the best ways to commit suicide. And I ventured into therapy when I was 18, psychoanalytically oriented therapy. And psychoanalytic therapy is based on the idea that the reason we have emotional problems is because of our dysfunctional family and our crazy parents and our addicted genes and those things.
Do you believe that?
What's that?
Do you believe that?
I don't believe that, but Sigmund Freud believed it, unfortunately, and his ideas became very popular for most of the 20th century, and the therapist I started with when I was 18 used this approach, and I felt good when I was talking to him because he was unconditionally accepting, didn't criticize me, and that was very nice. But in between sessions, when I was depressed or anxious or unassertive or procrastinating, I had no idea what to do about that. So at the end of about a year working with him and getting nowhere, I heard Albert Ellis speak on the radio and then went to a talk of his, read a few of his books, and what he said made a lot of sense to me, and part of it was critical of traditional therapy for good reason. So I started at 19 in therapy with Albert Ellis, and that dramatically changed my life.
Now I
teach people the same things he taught me and help them significantly.
Well, that's
great. And everything in the book, what's that?
Does the help come more quickly with this method?
Well, this method is the same method Albert Ellis used. Everything in the book, 3-Minute Therapy, is based on Albert Ellis's Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy, REBT. So it's the same approach. I tried to streamline it a bit and make it more succinct, but that's the basic idea, and it does come very quickly. The average stay in therapy is 8 to 10 sessions, even with lifelong depression or severe addictions or panic attacks or whatever it is, however long you've had it. If you do the exercises that I teach you in my therapy sessions or the book teaches you, then that makes all the difference.
Well, that certainly sounds like a much less costly venture and a much more helpful one.
Yeah, psychoanalysis would go on for years and years and 4 or 5 times a week, which is very costly for the client and very lucrative for the therapist.
And for the price of $21.95 with the discount, you can solve your problems, it sounds like. Which, by the way, when Michael's manuscript first came to us at our publishing house, Glenbridge Publishing Limited, we read the book. And we said, we have to try this. And both my husband and I tried the exercises, and I must say they are extremely helpful, even if you don't have serious problems. If you, let's say you're in an office, and there are 50 people, and somebody says the wrong thing to you in the morning when you come in, I think most people carry that negative feeling. And it grows. The more you think about it, the worse it gets. Would you agree with that?
Well, to some extent, it depends on how you think about it. If you think, I must not be criticized, I must not be criticized, this proves I'm no good, then certainly the more you dwell on that, the worse you feel. But if you learn to give up those musts and think, well, I prefer not to be criticized, that's too bad, that's unfortunate, doesn't feel good, but what can I learn from it, or how can I deal with it and make my life better in the long run, then you won't feel bad. You might even feel good about a new challenge and a new way to improve your life.
Well, there are two things I think that permeate America, and that is overeating and alcoholism. Let's start with overeating. How do you think your program can help someone who has this problem?
Well, if we go back to the basic principles that, and one of the main ones is, it's never situations themselves that forces you to feel anything, depressed, anxious, or angry, or forces you to do anything, like compulsively eat or compulsively drink. It's not the temptation of the chocolate staring you in the face or someone offering you a drink that forces you to overeat or drink. And it's not the urge or craving you have or physiological response you have that forces you to do it, but rather it's thoughts in your head, what you're telling yourself. And again, we get back to the must, which you mentioned earlier, Mary, that because I strongly prefer to have the chocolate, I absolutely must have it. I couldn't stand denying myself. It would be the end of the world. So I have to indulge right now. So it's those musts and shoulds, usually some demand for comfort or to avoid frustration that leads to addictive behavior. So again, we go back to 3-minute exercises, which basically teach you to question, challenge, and contradict those beliefs and see that you don't have to quell your frustration and urge right now. You can face discomfort and you'll survive. And that these feelings wax and wane, they'll pass with time. And that if you go for the quick fix and have the drink or have the chocolate, you'll feel good for the moment, most likely, but feel much more uncomfortable in the long run when the consequences hit you.
Well, when you say it, it sounds so simple. Do you think that everyone can do these exercises and benefit from them, or are there just some people who give up too easily?
Well, you raise a good point there about how simple it sounds, and some people might dismiss these ideas because they say it's too simple, it's simplistic, it can't work. But Although the ideas are simple and crystal clear, and that's one of the beauties of this approach and Albert Ellis's genius in devising it, it's not easy. It takes, just like learning anything, to learn to think in terms of preferences rather than musts and shoulds, it takes practice, reinforcement, repetition, going over it again and again and again. And in the book, 3-Minute Therapy, I show you many ways you can do that. But unless you sit down and make it a discipline to practice these exercises on a regular basis, then there's no magic. Your thinking normally won't change, and you'll stick to your addictive thinking and be addicted forever. But the good news is the exercises are simple, and most people can learn how to do them and practice them.
Well, it would seem to me that everyone can afford 3 minutes several times a day, wouldn't you say?
Well, it depends on their priorities. If they want to get over their alcohol addiction or their eating addiction and not die of heart disease, cancer, or brain problems, then certainly I would think they would find a few minutes every day.
In reading the book, you have a very interesting approach to the problems of alcohol. How do you see alcohol? Is it an addiction you can never get over? What about AA and programs? What is your thinking in that area?
Well, AA, unfortunately, is very, very popular in terms of dealing with alcohol problems. And although some people are helped some of the time, there are some major problems that I see with AA. And one is they have 12 steps. And the first step is admitting that you're powerless over your addiction. And that's a problem when someone thinks they're powerless, because it doesn't really make sense, and it's a great excuse to drink. If you're powerless, what can you do? The alcohol has power over you. But the truth is, if you're taking a drink, if you're buying the beer and then pouring it in a glass and swallowing it, the beer didn't force you to do that. It didn't knock you down and pour itself down your throat, but you did it. You chose to do that, so you have the power to drink, so you could use that power in a more constructive way to not drink. And in fact, if you think about it, getting over a food or alcohol or substance addiction is the simplest thing in the world. Just do nothing. The chocolate isn't going to make you eat it, and neither is the alcohol, but you can decide to do nothing, not give in to the discomfort you feel, and that's a great way to get over your addiction.
How do you feel over the years that you've practiced that people respond to this with alcoholism?
Well, usually the people that I work with, both in my private practice and in self-help groups that I am the professional advisor for in San Francisco, called Smart Recovery, which is based on this approach, and there are Smart Recovery groups all around the country, and people can find out more about that at the website smartrecovery.org. People who come often know that what they've tried before doesn't work for them. They're looking for a new, fresh approach, and they take very well to it. They see it makes sense, and they see it's not very complicated and doesn't go back to their childhood or diseases or things like that. And they generally work hard at it and tend to be successful.
Oh, that's amazing. That truly is amazing. What about the old philosophy of going back to the childhood and blaming the parents and all of those things? How do you feel about that?
Well, again, it seems like it's going up the garden path the wrong direction, because as we were discussing earlier, it's never situations themselves, past, present, or future, that forces you to feel anxious or depressed, but it's your thinking about those situations, and that goes for your childhood. You could have had abusive parents or a poor childhood or been homeless, but that doesn't mean you have to be disturbed now as an adult, because your childhood and your past is dead and gone. It can't reach up from the grave and grab you and do anything to you. It's whether you dwell on it and upset yourself about it or just move on with your life that really counts.
So what you're saying is traumatic childhood experiences and may have left a scar, but they don't have to affect you as an adult if you approach 3-minute therapy.
That's right. They don't affect you as an adult. You affect yourself about it if you choose to. And I've heard that metaphor about a scar, but there is no scar because it gets back to your thinking. Are you saying to yourself, this shouldn't have happened to me, it's unfair, I can't stand it, my parents are rotten and deserve to roast in hell? That's just what people probably call the scar, but that's just a belief in your head. It's just your thoughts. And if it's your thoughts that's upsetting you about your childhood, obviously you can change your thinking and stop upsetting yourself. Also, there is a tendency, even in therapy these days, to spend a lot of time on blaming your parents and what did your parents do when you were 3 years old and how did you react, and that's why you have problems now. Your parents criticized you, so you don't get along in relationships as an adult, but that's way off the reality of it. The reality of it is it's you, what you say to yourself, your self-talk, your beliefs, that's a problem. So take full responsibility for your problem, your emotional problems, not for the abuse. You're not responsible for the abuse, but for your current emotional problems, you're responsible for that, and you can change that because it means changing your entire philosophy about your thinking.
That's intriguing. People often know that they're acting irrationally or crazy or thinking oddly, yet somehow the knowledge often doesn't help. Would you agree?
Oh, yes, and that's a very important point. People will come to a session or read the book, and they say, well, what you say makes perfect sense. I know that there's no reason to be anxious. I know I'm not a worthless failure if I fall flat on my face or fail at something, but yet I'm still anxious. It didn't help. And the issue is that there are two types of learning that I call level one learning and level two learning. Level one learning is when you have a superficial recognition that your thinking doesn't make sense and you're doing it to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not enough to change anything. It means getting to level two. Level two is where you have a deep conviction that your musts and shoulds and demands and self-condemnation is false, that it doesn't make sense, that you can accept yourself unconditionally no matter what, whether people criticize you or you fail or not. And so that's level two, when you are deeply convinced of that. So the question is, how do you get from level one, a superficial recognition of the reality, to level two? And the answer is by using the same learning process we use to learn most things. And that says reinforcement is the royal road to learning. The more you reinforce and practice the new way of looking at things, the more functional way of looking at things, using the 3-minute exercise and other exercises in 3-minute therapy book, the more you practice it, just like learning anything else, learning to play the piano, learning French, learning math, learning to drive a car, learning to tie your shoelace, the more you practice something, the more you build new pathways in your brain, the better you get at it. And thinking in terms of preferences rather than demands and absolutes follows the same learning process. Practice, repetition, reinforcement is what gets you from level one to level two.
I'd like to interject here that Dr. Edelstein is an award-winning author. He was named Author of the Year by his peers, the National Association of Cognitive Behavioral Therapists, and his book has been translated into Japanese now in a second edition. And if you live in Albania, it's about to come out in Albanian. So it certainly is making its rounds around the world. Dr. Edelstein, by the way, has appeared on more than 350 interviews and is invited back again and again. And for those of you who go to our site, which is glenbridgepublishing.com, you will see an amazing number of reviews that come from people none of us know from all over the world, literally, and you can see more than 55 five-star reviews on Amazon. It's quite amazing that people came from everywhere to say how much it's helped them. That's that's quite a wonderful thing, Michael.
Oh, yes, and it's wonderful how, with the advent of the Internet, people can be helped all around the world, as you were saying, Mary. And I get emails from people in Europe and Africa and other places saying how much reading the book helped them. So that is terrific.
You know that we have listeners from as many as 190 countries, so you may be hearing more.
Oh, great.
We were looking at talking about shoulds and musts. And is there anything in life that we must do when you talk about not everything should be musts and shoulds?
Well, that's the bottom line. And as I tell my clients, there are no musts, there are no shoulds. There's nothing you have to do except maybe die one day. But one day we'll figure out a way to get around that, but not yet.
Probably true.
But otherwise, there's nothing you must do. You don't have to get approval. You don't have to have an easy life. Life doesn't have to be fair. People don't have to treat you kindly, considerately, and lovingly. It would be nice, and if they don't, you don't want to say, well, who cares? It doesn't matter. That's the other extreme. But there is no reason why anything has to be the way you want it to be. And if you were elected ruler of the universe and you controlled everything, then you could say, well, somebody must treat me nicely, and then they have no choice. They treat you nicely. But as far as I know, no one I've heard of has been elected ruler of the universe. So musts and shoulds are always false. And similarly, the conclusions from musts and shoulds, I'm no good, you're no good, life is horrible, that as well is false, because we are not no good. We're just good at some things, poor at other things, and humans are always changing. So we're just imperfect humans who act imperfectly, never worthless failures. And the same with other people who treat us poorly. They're imperfect humans. They don't deserve to be condemned and regaled for their discretion, but rather spoken to if possible, or avoided if not possible. And same with life. Life consists of hassles and frustration. Life consists of one frustration after another, but in between the frustrations, there are also some joys and pleasures and fulfillment. So all these things are multivaried, and global conclusions about oneself, others, and life are always false, as well as musts and shoulds are always false.
Here's a question I'd like to toss in. It would, perhaps a statement as much as a question. It would seem to me, if everyone, and wouldn't that be wonderful, if everyone could solve their problems this way, would they be less likely to have diseases? In other words, would it not help your daily health?
You mean physical health?
Yes.
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think the studies are somewhat inconclusive. It's hard to do a controlled study on whether someone who's anxious has more problems than that same person if they weren't anxious, because we just have one person to deal with. And so I really don't know the answer to that, but I think the main thing is that if you do have medical problems and you learn to be accepting rather than hating yourself or hating the world because you have the problems, then you'd certainly be better off and be able to deal with the illnesses much more effectively.
Yes, I would agree. You have an interesting philosophy about self-esteem. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Most people, and especially therapists and self-esteem writers, would say that if someone's depressed, they're likely to have low self-esteem, feel bad about themselves, and I would agree with that. But they say the solution is high self-esteem, feel good about yourself, and I would not agree with that, because whether you it's just two sides of the same coin. Whether you feel bad about your total self or good about your total self, it's still an overgeneralization, and it comes from self-rating. It says, because I do well at X, Y, or Z, or because people like me, that means I'm a good person. You're rating your total personhood, your humanity, based on these things, how you act or what people think of you, and that's false. No matter who loves you or who hates you or how well you do or how poorly you do, you're still just an imperfect human who acts imperfectly, never a god or a devil, and things could always change. So my solution to the self-esteem problem is not try to convince yourself you're a wonderful person and God's gift to the human race, but rather that you're an imperfect human who acts imperfectly, who can set goals and get enjoyment out of life by working toward goals and sometimes achieving them, and that's called unconditional self-acceptance, USA, accepting yourself unconditionally no matter what, whether you do well or poorly or people approve of you or disapprove of you, you can still accept yourself, focus on your goals, and try to achieve your goals in life.
Sounds wonderful. How about anger? You know, we all of us get angry at times, sometimes a little bit, sometimes it just seems to grow with some people. You can sit down at a dinner table and one person may be angry at something that happened at his home, and it seems to come out, you know, even in the tone of voice. How do you deal with that?
Well, I have a chapter in 3-Minute Therapy on anger. It's called The High Price of Losing Your Cool. And if you think about it, anger, as opposed to assertiveness and expressing your feelings in a reasonable way, never really helps. It just tends to make things worse. So the first way to deal with it is to see that anger doesn't help. It just eats you up inside. It's associated with physical problems such as high blood pressure and heart disease and other ills, so you'd be better off without anger. So the way to deal with it is use the same process that you would use with these other problems we've been discussing, and that is first ask yourself, what am I telling myself? It's not my boss's unfair criticism that forces me to be angry. It's not the situation, but it's me, what I'm telling myself, my demands, such as, my boss must not be so unfair. He must not criticize me with no good reason. He should treat me well because I'm such a hard worker and such a wonderful person. So there are those musts and shoulds to identify, and then the next step is to question them and dispute them and contradict them and show yourself, there is no reason my boss must treat me fairly. It would be lovely, that would be wonderful if my boss was always fair, but it's hardly the end of the universe if my boss is unfair. It is very uncomfortable, I don't like it, but I survived discomfort when criticized before and I'll survive it again. It's not my boss's criticism that forces me to be angry, but rather it's my musts and shoulds in my head, just those thoughts, and I can change my thinking. I can still have a happy life, even if my boss continues to criticize me unfairly, although I'd be much happier if he treated me better. So you remind yourself of a better perspective, an unangry perspective, and then you could talk to your boss if you think that would be appropriate and see if you can work out a better relationship. Or you can say nothing and just grit your teeth and bear it because the paycheck outweighs the criticism. Or you can look for another job. So there are various practical approaches you can take to criticism rather than getting angry, which doesn't help.
You mentioned earlier that procrastination was something that bothered you as a young person. Procrastination is fairly common, wouldn't you say?
Yes. In fact, I would say that procrastination is the most common psychological problem people have, and it's so common, most therapists don't even recommend it and don't deal with it in therapy, probably because they're great procrastinators also, so it seems normal to them. But it is a very, very common problem, and again, it's amenable to this approach, and I have a long chapter in my book suggesting various techniques and strategies people can use to deal with procrastination, overcome it, and again, there's a 3-minute exercise identifying the musts and shoulds, your procrastinating thinking that causes procrastination, and undermining that through practice and reinforcement.
Yes, I do want to mention that Dr. Edelstein's website. Michael, you can go ahead and give that. There's so much on there for people who are interested in all of the things that you're talking about.
Yes, the website URL is simply the name of the book, 3-Minute Therapy. Three is spelled out, T-H-R-E-E, minutetherapy.com.
And you can find all kinds of interviews that Dr. Edelstein has done, a ton of them, as a matter of fact. And there is also something that Glenbridge Publishing just started. We have Ask Dr. Mike, and people come with questions, and we have a few of those up right now on our site as well, and that's glenbridgepublishing.com. Michael, I think you talked about various elements. How did you come to know Albert Ellis, who was the founder of Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy, as you mentioned?
Well, that was very lucky on my part. When I was 18 and I was in the psychoanalytically oriented therapy, I just happened to hear him being interviewed on the radio. And what he was saying made a lot of sense to me. So I got his book, one of his books, and read it, and that made a lot of sense to me. And then I went to a talk he gave, and at the talk he wasn't shy about criticizing the kind of therapy I was in, psychoanalytically oriented therapy, which is sometimes these days called psychodynamic therapy, which assumes that it's your childhood that's a problem, your parents that's a problem, and the thing to do is to deal with that and go over it and over it ad nauseum. So that made a lot of sense. And then my sister, who was at Albert Ellis's talk with me, immediately started seeing him for therapy and found it very helpful, and she recommended, since I was getting nowhere with my therapist, she recommended I see him, which I did, and the results were quite amazing.
You did become lifelong friends with him and actually appear with him, did you not?
Yes. I appeared with him. In fact, he wrote the introduction to 3-Minute Therapy, a very nice introduction, when he would come, I moved to San Francisco about 20 years ago, and when he would come to San Francisco to do a workshop, we often got together for a meal, and it was really a wonderful experience knowing him.
Well, perhaps someone tonight who is listening will feel the same way about what you're talking about in 3-Minute Therapy. We never know who we touch, do we?
That's right. You never know. And sometimes people will send me emails about the book or asking me questions. And then a year later, they might call up and make an appointment because they've been using the approach and they could use some reinforcement or further insights. So that's very true. Also, I wanted to mention, Mary, that in addition to in-person therapy in my San Francisco office, I also do telephone therapy around the country and around the world. I've had clients in the Philippines, Thailand, Kiev, Western Europe, and especially with Skype these days, which makes phone calls from all around the world very clear and free, phone therapy works quite well.
How can you tell when you're dealing with someone whether a telephone is going to work? In other words, perhaps there are people where this might not work. What's your thinking on that?
Well, my thinking is that, and I'm asked that question a lot, and the answer is, suppose you want to learn French and you're coming to a French tutor, and you say, well, will this work? Well, the answer is kind of obvious. If you practice the French on a regular basis, it'll work. You'll learn some French. You may not speak fluently like a Parisian, but certainly if you practice regularly, you'll be able to go to Paris and get directions and ask where's the bathroom and those kinds of things. And it's the same with this. If you practice conscientiously, there's no reason why you won't dramatically improve, just like you can go from speaking no French to speaking French at the passable level. But I never know in the first session who's going to work conscientiously and who's not, so I can't tell you after one or two sessions who I think will do better. But it's a person who works hard and conscientiously at these exercises.
I would think everyone would like to be able to make their life more pleasant with reasonable thinking.
Oh, yes. That's the goal that most people have. The problem is that most people, or many people, are procrastinators and are unwilling to do the exercises, so the ideas might make a lot of sense to them, but they don't work at it, so they don't change very much.
I noticed that I don't know what the cost of therapy is if you initially, and things have changed, everything's more expensive, but it would seem to me that three-minute therapy would save an individual months and thousands of dollars. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, the course of therapy is usually about 8 to 10 sessions, not months and months and months or years and years. And then people learn new ways of looking at things that benefit them for the rest of their life, new concepts, new strategies that they can use on their own if they get anxious after they finish with therapy. They're not dependent on me anymore. They can do it themselves, deal with the anxiety, and get over it using these same strategies that I teach them.
Is it possible to give us some examples of unique things that have happened that were beneficial for clients? You know, there's a situation that they just discovered how quickly it could change.
Oh, yes. One particular example that comes to mind is someone I was working with who was in his 30s, and he had been depressed all his life, deeply depressed, and he was on the road to being a musician, and he went to Juilliard, and he was doing well, but he got so depressed he just didn't feel he could hack it and dropped out, and he tried electroshock therapy, and that didn't help him, and then he tried antidepressants, that didn't help him, and then when he learned this approach and started doing the three-minute exercises about 2 or 3 times a day, then that changed his life dramatically, and he got over his depression. And when once in a while he would skip a few days and stop doing the exercises, and then he'd begin to feel the depression slowly coming back. So he'd get right on the track and do the three-minute exercises again. So that was a particularly dramatic case, but not that unusual. I've worked with many people who've been deeply depressed, who tried various types of therapy, nothing helped, and then this dramatically helped them in a short period of time.
That's pretty amazing. So he was able to get rid of the drugs he was taking.
Well, actually, he wasn't taking the drugs because they didn't help. So when he saw me, he had stopped the electroshock therapy because that didn't help. He had stopped the drugs because that didn't help. And he was sort of at the end of his rope.
Very interesting. Well, I think it's often meeting the right person at the right time, reading something that just clicks in the brain, and maybe those things come along just at the right time for people.
Yes.
Hopefully it comes along at the right time.
Yeah, and hopefully they take advantage of it. Another common case that I've had, which I find very rewarding, is a couple will come in and they're relationship is on the rocks, and they come in the first session, all they're doing is venomously criticizing each other and trying to prove that they're right and the other one's wrong, and it's not them who needs therapy, but it's their husband or wife who needs a therapy. And then after a few sessions, once I get them going on these exercises, I can see a dramatic change just in how they relate to each other in my office and just how they sit. Instead of sitting on opposite ends of the couch, they sit next to each other and they talk civilly to each other. And that also is very rewarding and wonderful to see.
You wrote something to me. Michael and I talk as we do with all of our authors. And Michael said, I'd like to make a personal statement. And what he said was, I'm very lucky that I discovered Albert Ellis and REBT, which is Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy, at the age of 19. I can't say enough about how it has improved my personal life and given me a career I love. I'm competent at what I do and feel deeply rewarded when I see my clients improve dramatically over a short course of therapy. That's a wonderful way to go to work every day.
Oh, yes. I greatly look forward to it. And at a social event, sometimes someone will approach me and they say, well, I, you probably don't want to be bothered with problems because you're helping people with that all day. But, and I tell them, oh, I'd be happy to discuss your problems with you. I love doing it. I love helping people. So I have a great time at the party curing people of their problems.
Yeah, but that's a very unique situation. Not too many people do that who are in the profession. You know, with all of the computer and all of the new apps and everything that is new every day and youngsters are getting involved, addictions, we talked about this briefly one day. Have you ever treated teenagers who are addicted to their phones?
I haven't treated teenagers addicted to their phones. I've treated teenagers addicted to computer games and Facebook. But
in other words, it's pretty much the same. Are teenagers happy to move in a positive direction, do you find?
Well, the ones I've worked with have... Most of them have been very happy to move in a positive direction, but that's they're self-selected. They wouldn't be here if they weren't motivated to change.
Sure.
So I've had some very rewarding experiences with teenagers working on not only internet addictions, but other kinds of addictions, alcohol, pot addictions, depression, those kinds of things.
What is the most serious thing that you discover in your patients? In other words, what is the most common thing that you deal with?
The most common problem I deal with is anxiety. Just about everyone's anxious some of the time, and many people are anxious most of the time. So that tends to be the most common problem, and then the second is depression. And as I mentioned earlier, procrastination seems to be the most common psychological problem people have, but they usually don't come to therapy for that. I think it's because they don't see it as a psychological problem. They tend to come to therapy for anxiety, depression, relationship problems, and addictions.
Now, you deal with relationships, and people at any age can have a relationship problem. What do you think? Is that an extremely prevalent problem, or is it a unique problem to certain age groups?
Oh, I think relationship problems are very prevalent, and the reason is it's hard enough for people to live with themselves because of their unrealistic and irrational thinking, their demands they put on themselves. So it makes it even more difficult when they're trying to live with someone else in addition to live with themselves. So it sort of potentiates the problem. So relationship problems are legion. And it's very sad because if people learn some of these simple strategies, and I also specialize in teaching them communication skills to improve their communication, which is often the practical problem, and then overcoming their emotional problem in relationships, which is often either hurt or resentment, when they start doing that, then things dramatically change. But unfortunately, they're not taught in school how to overcome emotional problems or good communication strategies. So it takes a psychologist to teach them that.
Do you think that stress and burnout has grown, especially with the economy as it is and the difficulties for people who are out of work? And is this something that you see more now, or it's pretty common no matter when?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I think it's pretty common no matter when, and that if someone has a generally realistic outlook on life, that then they deal with difficult problems like losing their job or the poor economic situation. They deal with that okay, and if they have a musty outlook, then they tend to get upset about these things and lots of other things. So I'm not so sure. I haven't done a survey or looked at it historically, but I'm not so sure that I would agree with many people who say stress is worse, burnout is worse, because we have more things to do with the computer and other things. It, intuitively, it sounds right, but I don't know if that's really the case.
Sometimes the best thing is just to sit down and to divorce yourself from all sound. I know when we're in the office or it's been a day that starts at 7 in the morning and goes to 8 o'clock in the evening, just peace and quiet, just sitting with no noise and no sound is the most beautiful thing in the world.
Yes, well, if you like no sound, then it's good for you to set aside times in your day when you don't have sound. Or I was working with someone yesterday who we discussed setting aside some time every day just for herself, a half hour a day just for herself. She has a number of children, and she's an attorney, and a marriage, and a home, and all those things. So she's on the go all the time, so we thought that it would be a good idea if she took a half hour a day just for herself, just to relax, read, or listen to music, or do yoga, or something like that. So that's often very useful.
I think that everyone could profit from that information. 3-minute therapy helps you, as you've heard, tackle problems that seem impossible. To make the impossible possible is a very exciting thing. And you can tackle problems that you've had with procrastination, depression, anxiety, addiction. And you, with all of this, you can become more effective in your own personal life and professional life. And I bet add years of healthier, happier living to your life. Would you agree, Michael?
Oh, yes. It sounds sort of too easy and too glib, but it's really the truth. And as you mentioned earlier, for over 30 years, I've been helping people do this. And as I discussed, I have helped myself with this. So it's really a shame that the word isn't out more about how people can improve their emotions, improve their behaviors, be more effective at achieving their goals, and have a more fulfilling life.
Now tell me, as a child, when did you first notice that you would prefer to be, you notice I said prefer, to be a different person?
Well, actually, it was when I was around 17 or 18, and my sister recommended therapy to me, and I may not have embarked on that if she didn't recommend that to me, because I didn't really know anything about it, and I didn't really know that there was a possibility of changing and overcoming my depression and anxiety. So that opened the door. So I guess it was about that age. But when I was younger and depressed, I didn't have a label for it, and I just thought that was this status quo. That's the way I was, and that's the way I'd always be, just like having brown eyes. So it was a wonderful new opportunity to see that something could be done about it.
Well, the idea of therapy frightens a lot of people, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I think
the word itself, you can see some people sort of, you can see a reaction.
Yes, I think that a lot of people do fear therapy, but I think fewer and fewer, because the word is getting out, that therapy doesn't mean uncovering deep, dark secrets from your past or your unconscious or finding out what horrible urges you have and those kinds of things. But so they're afraid that they're going to be found out or that they're going to be shown to be a phony or a hypocrite or an awful person. But I think as the word gets out more and more with books like 3-Minute Therapy, and Albert Ellis has written over 80 books.
That's amazing. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And things have changed dramatically in terms of how people view therapy and what it involves. And it doesn't involve excavating deep, dark secrets in your unconscious, but rather identifying some of your thinking in the present and changing that. I think people have a more and more realistic outlook about it, and there is not such fear as there once was of going into therapy. In fact, when I first started doing therapy around 30 years ago, the Freudian notion about your childhood and your unconscious was still quite popular, and usually the first few sessions with my clients were taken up by my trying to persuade them that it's not your childhood that's doing it to you, it's not your unconscious, it's not your crazy parents, but rather it's your thinking. So that occupied some amount of time. But these days when people come in, when I tell them this, they catch on very quickly, and I don't have to spend a lot of time trying to persuade them out of the Freudian notion about the childhood and your parents and what caused your problems.
Is rejection something you deal with as well?
Oh, yes.
For young people, would you say, or is this cover the whole platter?
Yeah, I think it covers the whole platter. And there are three main musts that people have, three core musts. And the first one deals with rejection, and it says, because I prefer it, I absolutely must do well and get approval, or else I'm no good. So that's the first demand. Second is a demand on others. Others must treat me kindly, fairly, courteously, and if they don't, they're no good, and that causes resentment, hostility, and anger. And then the third must is demand on the impersonal conditions of one's life. Life must be fair, easy, and hassle-free, and if it's not, life is awful, and I have to be miserable forever. So the first must, I must do well and get approval, deals very much with rejection, and it's a very common problem. And as I mentioned earlier, Mary, anxiety is the most common disturbed emotion people have, and anxiety often comes from that must. I must not be rejected. I must do well. I must get approval. I must not look like a fool, etc. And in fact, the most common phobia people have, or fear people have, is the fear of public speaking.
Interesting.
And some surveys have shown more people fear public speaking than fear death.
Oh.
And the reason for their fear of public speaking often is, I must not make a fool of myself, I must not look stupid, I must not seem anxious, I must not, my mind must not go blank, and if it does, it proves I'm no good, I'm an idiot, and it's a shameful thing. So certainly the fear of rejection is a major aspect of humans' emotional disturbance.
Hmm. I have a paragraph here which is so Dr. Edelstein. This is about overcoming panic attacks. Do you recognize these symptoms? A pounding heart, legs feeling weak and trembling, a tight throat, lightheadedness, fears of a heart attack or going crazy. While simultaneously you hate yourself for foolishly worrying about these feelings, which your physician assured you were nothing. This is a hallmark of panic attacks. I think there is unbelievable fear from people I know who suffer panic attacks fairly regularly.
Oh, yes, it's a very common problem, and it's a very solvable problem. Often panic attacks overlap with a problem called secondary disturbance, and I have a chapter in 3-Minute Therapy about secondary disturbance and a chapter about panic attacks. And what secondary disturbance means is you're upset about being upset or you're anxious about being anxious. And often with panic attacks, someone starts to get anxious, their heart starts racing for some reason, or they start sweating, or they start feeling faint. And then so they're feeling anxious, and then they get anxious about that, and they start thinking, I must not be anxious. I must not be so upset. I must not have a panic attack. I must not have a panic attack. And that magnifies their anxiety, makes them more anxious, and then sometimes develops into a full-blown panic attack just because they're saying, paradoxically, I must not have a panic attack. So the solution, again, is acceptance. Accepting anxiety, you're human, and humans are anxious. There's no reason why you absolutely must not be. It would be lovely if you weren't, but you're going to be anxious at times. And the more you accept that and see and allow yourself to be anxious rather than fight it, try to squelch it, those kinds of things, which just makes it worse, the more you accept that, the more you'll do better in avoiding panic attacks.
I think we can, a very charming idea that I remember seeing in one of your emails to me, you'll become so wrapped up in this entertaining book, and by the way, it is very entertaining, you'll forget about your personal problems. That's a good step as well. You'll learn how to take control of your life, and you will refuse to be a victim. You'll quickly become aware of positive improvements in your life. With 3-Minute Therapy, change your thinking, change your life, by Dr. Michael Edelstein, and you can find much more about Dr. Edelstein at glenbridgepublishing.com, and you'll want to go to Dr. Edelstein's site, 3minutetherapy.com, to enjoy much of what he has on his site. And Michael, I feel that knowing you for many years now, your book has drawn more comments than any other book we've had, and we have over 60 titles right now. So that's quite a message.
Well, it's good to hear. I didn't realize that. And it's nice that after the book being on the market for about 13 years, it's still doing reasonably well on Amazon, selling lots of copies.
Yes, it's doing very well. And we continue to do interviews. And I certainly have enjoyed my time with you this evening, Michael, and want to thank you. By the way, Dr. Edelstein's office is in San Francisco, California. And you can find out more at his website. But this has been very enjoyable. While I've dealt with the books for so long, I still feel so strongly about how helpful it is. And there are not a lot of books that have a lasting quality. So we thank you for that, and we are delighted to have you as our guest this evening. And we're happy to have our listening audience and look forward to seeing you again next week. Good night, Michael. And
good night,
Mary. To
I appreciate your kind words, and thanks for having me.
You're most welcome, and good night to everyone.